From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past spring when a group of national experts issued a new recommendation that will affect millions of Americans. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force issued an updated recommendation for breast cancer screening. Mammograms every other year for people at average risk starting at age 40. Experts say the guidelines have changed due to an increase in the number of people under age 50 who've been diagnosed with breast cancer. Previously, the guidelines recommended that mammograms begin at age 50 and that women age 40 to 49 should consider being screened based on personal risk. Speaking to NPR in April, the previous chair of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, Dr. Carol Mangione, said that if all women followed the new recommendation, mortality from breast cancer could be reduced in this country by about 20%. That could save 8,000 lives annually. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and we're not big on what's called calendar journalism on Connections. There's a month or a day or a week for everything, but we think all of these issues are important year-round. It just happens that you're going to be seeing, as you always do, a lot of pink ribbons, a lot of pink marketing, and a lot of focus on this month. And we wanted to sit down with the experts to talk about what you ought to know when it comes to breast cancer awareness, screening, treatment, and support for those who are diagnosed. And while early detection is important, advocates also want to remind us that people with metastatic disease need support too. We'll talk about a legislative push at the federal level that could help families navigating that aspect of the disease. And we'll try to answer any questions you have about breast cancer screening and support. You can email the program. It's connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me welcome our guest now. Dr. Avis O'Connell is back with us, a radiologist with Rochester Regional Health. Dr. O'Connell, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to Christina Thompson, Executive Director of the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester. Hello, Christina.
Hello.
And welcome to Becky Arcady, who's a survivor, and it's great to have Becky with us. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
So, Avis, we've talked many times over the years, and the conversation is always first about what is new, what perhaps is changing, and where the current guidelines are now. So let me just kind of start there with you and ask you, for people who get confused, they say, oh, I thought it used to be 50, or is it 45, is it 40? Where are we now with this?
Right. This is a good place to start. So what's new is that the guidelines were updated again this year by the USPS task force, and taking away, it's an improvement. So it starts with women of average risk, we can talk about risk, should start getting regular screenings at age 40 and every 1 to 2 years. We actually, they're getting close. We think it should be every year. It's like, why not? Because in that interval, you know, cancer signs could show. So definitely start at age 40 every year, we think, and end, they say 74, and we say, knowing a lot of 74-year-olds, we say as long as the person has the health and interest of for coming. 10-year life expectancy, people used to say, but who knows?
Okay. So, all right, so a couple questions there before we kind of continue on. Even though the current recommendation have moved this line to age 40 for all women, regardless of family risk, every other year, you and many of your colleagues who you've spoken to say you think eventually it's going to settle on every year.
We would like that because there's what's known as interval cancers. A fast-growing cancer could appear in the year between at age 41. You have your first one at 40. At 41, there could be some signs, and you wait another year. Earlier is better, as we all know. That's pretty good.
And, you know, let me ask kind of just a question about how this notion of interval cancer and how fast cancer moves. So I've been thinking a lot about cancer lately. Lost my stepfather just a few weeks ago. He had a good long life, but he had survived so many ailments. And when cancer came back, for him it was a return of Merkel cell carcinoma, which is apparently the most deadly skin cancer, unusual but pretty dangerous. It was very fast, metastasized very fast, and really caught his family off guard with the speed of it. Now, that's not the same. Merkel cell carcinoma is not breast cancer. I don't know how quickly it typically moves, but having had plenty of people around me who've had breast cancer, there is a feeling that, like, you know, sometimes there's a natural inclination, Dr. O'Connell, to say, well, why not every 6 months? Why not three? I mean, like, I want to keep getting scanned because in that interval, I'm worried about mm-hmm. what is happening in my body. So what is a typical spread? Is that a fair question?
Well, it's a good question, but cancers grow at all kinds of rates. Okay. I mean, we have this thing called overdiagnosis, where if you see a little clump of calcium in a 75-year-old, they probably won't die from that. And if it is DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, we're considered to have overdiagnosed that if we get all excited and give them full treatment. However, somebody in their 40s or younger, I think, has so much more to lose, years of life lost. So if anything we can do, and a mammogram in the big picture is not a very difficult, you wish it wasn't painful, but a mammogram is the best way to get a hint that something's changing. Now, there are still cancers that will be palpable, that you can feel them before you see them, but there are some that you see before you feel, so to give yourself the best possible choice. And interval cancers tend to be faster growing, so they're the ones you want to find. So we get to what people feel as well. It's not just, you can't just get the mammogram. That's just hugely important. You can't get your mammogram, walk out the door and say, oh, I'm good, there is no cancer in my breast. I wish that was true. But it's not. There still could be cancer in your breast. So you have to both check your breasts. And if you get, now my next point is the density legislation, mm-hmm. which is also new this year. And so let me go into that next.
Yeah.
In September of this year, for the first time, every state in this union, country, continent, needs to send a letter to the patients in lay terms to say what their mammogram looked like. Now, 40 states already did that. New York did that. But now every single state to get their federal funding has to tell the patient in their lay letter, your breasts are dense or they're not dense. We used to just say it was dense. Now you have to say your breasts are dense. So let me just back up a little on density. Say there are four densities, A, B, C, D. C and D are dense, A and B are not. If you get the dense letter, it then goes down and says, this is what it means in lay terms. Your breasts are dense. It's very normal. It's very common. However, a double whammy, cancers can hide there. And unfortunately, there are more cancers in dense breasts than there are in fatty breasts. So it's a double whammy. So the best thing you can do, though, is get a mammogram because it, now we'll go back to legislation, because thanks to, oh gosh, some pre-Obamacare, every woman in this country over the age of 40, it's 40 though, even though younger women may need one, over the age of 40 can have a free to them mammogram. Every year from the age of 40. That means no copay, no deductible. You can walk in. Unfortunately, if we say, well, now you need an ultrasound, that's more legislation hopefully coming up, but which we can talk about later. It's called the Find It Early Act. However, right now, a person has to pay their deductible or their copay to get the ultrasound. So it's not just like, oh, you're dense, so why don't we just walk you in the other room and do an ultrasound? We can't do that.
So you'd like to see that change?
That needs to be changed. There are a few states, a few very generous states, Connecticut I know is the first one, that if they tell you you need a supplemental screening with ultrasound, it will be covered completely.
Because you've probably seen over the years, if a patient, a potential patient knows that a screening will be free, but any follow-up that's necessary is not, they may not get the screening.
Absolutely. Because remember, now I'll give you the numbers, 1 in 10, so 10% of people are called back. And that callback is then diagnostic. It's not free anymore. And everything done on the callback has to go through their insurance. See, that's another thing. And I've had people say just what Evan said, that, oh, yeah, the mammogram is free, but you always do extra views and then I get a bill.
Yeah. So could we eventually see that change, everyone? I mean, maybe this is where I, Christina, what do we want to see change in that landscape here?
Well, that's a big question, Evan. And to answer that, as someone who was diagnosed with breast cancer at 39 before screening mammograms were a thing, having very dense breast tissue, we know at the Breast Cancer Coalition, mammograms are not a perfect tool. The Find It Early Act is really helpful, however, in reducing barriers and using a very important tool in helping to diagnose breast cancer and making it equitable for everyone. So that is something we had Congressman Joe Morelli in to really talk about a couple of weeks ago. And I think that is a great big step.
You're optimistic.
I am optimistic, yes.
And this has to be solved at the federal level?
Yes.
Okay.
It needs bipartisan Absolutely. Contributions. I mean, you think that and the other legislation that he's working on, the metastatic
breast cancer access to care.
Access to care. Those two, in a civilized society, you would think those two should be no-brainers, both sides. It doesn't matter what your politics is.
Right.
Here's the thing. Every single person in Congress has a mother, a sister, a friend, a daughter, or themselves who had breast cancer. There's not one person. I give lectures and I say, everybody in the room, you start with who, you don't go personal and say who personally. You say, who has a close family relative or friend with breast cancer, and just about every hand goes up. Mm-hmm. So how that legislation doesn't go through, it boggles my mind.
Yeah. So that'll be one to follow going forward here. But let me just close the loop on a couple of other points here. It was about 15 years ago that we had the last change in recommendations. And 15 years ago, the task force recommended women begin screenings at age 50, which is why a lot of listeners today may be hearing 40 and say, wait, I thought it was 50. Well, it was. That was 15 years ago. The new guidance is 40 for everybody. But if it's in your family, Dr. O'Connell, when?
10 years earlier than the age of the youngest person. If your grandmother was 45, then you should start at 35. So you've hit something there, is that people of average risk. So now we're into what is risk? What family is? Does your grandmother in her 80s count? Or is your mother in her 40s count? Or if you have no family history, because we really need to get to that. Under 40, how many people, we know, we in this room know a lot of people who had cancer diagnosis under 40. They didn't get their first mammogram yet. So now we come to my last one. Feel something, do, you know that, see something, say something. I want to do a slogan, feel something, do something. I mean, do something. Mm-hmm. Go to your doctor and say, I have, this feels different. Something is different. And you really do have to know what's normal for yourself. Don't examine your own breast thing is ridiculous. You've got two breasts and you've got a lifetime. You need to know. You feel something, go to your doctor, say, I need this checked. And don't take no for an answer. So if you're really young, in your 20s, get an ultrasound. Because people in their 20s are getting breast cancer. Get an ultrasound at least. Get a mammogram and an ultrasound, because two together sometimes are better. But don't do nothing. Feel something, do something.
Okay. Now, again, so that guideline, 10 years in advance of the age of the youngest person in your family.
Yeah. First, you know, if it was a great-great-great-grand-aunt, anyway, close relative, if you had aunts, so that gets us to the family history. When we see the family history of several aunts had breast cancer, so not first-degree relatives, in their 40s, then you should consider that a red flag. Multiple people premenopausal is one of the flags.
Okay. And I'm looking at the way that this curve has come lower and lower in age. And I'm wondering, are we, because you just said you see patients in their 20s. Hopefully it's not all that common, but it's not impossible. Are we diagnosing it better now, or are we seeing more breast cancer?
There's two things, right? The same with colon cancer. For some reason, younger people are getting cancers.
Yeah.
Breast cancers in their 20s, ridiculous. And 30s is almost like it's common now. I won't say common, but of course I see the ones, so it seems common to me. Mm-hmm. But colon cancer too. So there's something that we don't know, and I hope somebody will work it out. Cancers are happening earlier to healthy people. These are not people who don't eat their... These are healthy people. So it's happening earlier. And are we finding it earlier? Well, if they don't come into us, we can't. But it's a combination. It's not just one thing. We're finding them earlier, which makes the survival seem longer. That's always an argument. If you're diagnosed at 40 instead of 42, you're going to survive longer because you're longer with the cancer. But mortality is also changing, and that's the one that really counts.
All right, so a couple more questions I have, and then we're going to talk to the other co-panelists here about what they make of all of this and their experiences. And listeners, again, if you've got questions, comments about breast cancer screenings, guidelines, and these really the new recommendations, it's 844-295-TALK. If you want to call the program, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI. If you call from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Is it possible, Dr. O'Connell, that 10 years from now, we're going to be talking about moving the recommendations starting at 30 for everyone?
What we are talking about is that people should have a risk assessment at maybe mid to late 20s. Somebody should look and see, what does your family look like? Even if you had multiple prostates and pancreas and thyroid, but not breast, there are so many more. This gets us into genetic testing. Mm-hmm. If you seem to be a cancer fan. So the idea is that people would have a really good evaluation in their 20s. I don't know who's going to do it. They don't, you know, but an evaluation before they turn 30 to see what their risks are. And depending on their risks, they might start with ultrasound, even MRIs as early as 25, depending on the risk. So I think, we don't want to do mammograms before 25. But even then, they're so dense, it's not much good. You know, but we still would do them on somebody who had a high risk, like somebody who had radiation for Hodgkin's, for example, their chest was in the field. We will start them at 25. I've seen a cancer in somebody at 29 who had radiation and it started with calcium. So it is worth doing on high risk people. But the general public with average risk, we're not going to go below age 40, I don't think.
Okay. But I mean, eventually, I mean, if someone was diagnosed at 39, 35, they could have a 25-year-old daughter in the future who says, that's 10 years younger than my mother was.
Yeah, we usually say, but not before. We say 10 years younger than your mother, but not before. I think 25 is where, really before age 30. We really don't feel comfortable doing mammograms, okay, except in exceptional, which I've just mentioned one.
Okay.
But at age 30, we would definitely start in somebody who had a strong family history.
Okay. Okay, and then the last question I had on this before I turn to your co-panelist, doctor, is, you mentioned genetic testing. Genetic testing is, it's not a silver bullet. But I wonder, I'm totally uneducated on this. I mean, is it more specific now? Is it better? Has it improved? Is there somewhere that it can still go to improve?
That's the right question to ask. When people say to us, my mother had breast cancer, but she got tested and she was negative. And I would give an easy guideline. If it was more than 10 years ago, the panel of genes that are being tested was less. The genetics, so that's why the oncologists and the geneticists will say, if somebody's diagnosed now with cancer and the family or even them haven't been recently tested, the panel of genes that are being tested for mutations is huge. There are so many. It's not just BRCA1 and 2 anymore. There's a dozen, at least, other syndromes that are associated with breast cancer. So yes, it has changed hugely. So if somebody does have triggers in their family, they would be sent to a geneticist who would decide, should we do a new panel of genetic tests? And then you find out, are you at high risk?
Christina Thompson, Executive Director of the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester. What do you make of the new recommendations? What do you think?
Well, as we said before, I really think it's a step in the right direction. I think that we're talking about trying to get the whole country on the same page, which is legislation, and that's going to be a tough battle. But something that you mentioned earlier about younger and younger people being diagnosed, as someone at 39 diagnosed and then doing genetic testing, everything came back negative. I really think that a lot of this is environmental exposures, and that's what's increasing, and that has got to have a part as to why people are being diagnosed at a younger age.
This is you just surmising that we're going to learn something about some sort of environmental exposure? Similar, by the way, to what we see with Parkinson's.
Well, I don't think it's new information. Okay. I just don't think that there's legislation out there banning some of these things from the products that we buy. It can be. So we've been working at the coalition on New York State legislation to remove toxic ingredients from cosmetics and personal care products. Mm. These are staggering amounts of things that we are not only financially paying to use, slathering them on our body.
What's an example?
There's PFAs in menstrual products that we put into our bodies. Take a look at any of the barcodes on your cosmetics, on your lotions, anything that you use, and find out what the ingredients are before using them, because there is research showing that these elevate the risk of hormone-dependent cancers like breast, like ovarian, like thyroid, like prostate. So it's not just women. The more that we know about younger people using these products is that the amount of exposure and doing it during times when the hormone activities in the body are going nuts, like puberty, like pregnancy, like lactation, increases all of these risks. So I'm thinking about my girls who already now will start screening around 29 and love to go shopping for products. And they don't really know much about what's in them right now. Mm-hmm. So that's legislation the coalition's been working on as well.
Dr. O'Connell, how do you feel about the research that Christina was just talking about?
I think it's so complicated. I think that this might be the perfect time for AI. I think you need a million people to put in all of their history for all their exposures, whether, you know, organic.
Products they've been taking.
You know, food they ate, what they did. We don't know enough. But I think this is the time of big data. I think this is the kind of big data where if enough people, but unfortunately to do a trial, you need a matching group of a million who didn't have all the exposure. And then you have to compare the two.
No, this may be, you're right. This may be an AI product.
It's an AI. I mean, you can put million. Yeah. But I think that colon is the other one and all cancers. So there's more we don't know. And obviously, the simpler products you can use, the better. But nobody's really drawn a line directly. It sounds like it can't be good. But I don't think anybody has said that people who've had breast cancer in their 30s put too much of something.
No, just the elevated risks, though. And honestly, holding the industry responsible for not removing these ingredients when we know that it can be done.
All right. Well, I want to get Becky's take on this too, because Becky, your diagnosis came at age 37.
That's correct.
And that was back in 2021.
That's right.
How are you doing these days?
Finally, I feel a little bit more like myself, so that's really exciting. It's been a long journey.
The diagnosis came as a shock to you?
Yeah. I don't have anybody in my immediate family who has dealt with breast cancer, and so I experienced some pain and went to my doctor, and that's when we got the mammogram and had the ultrasound, and it was discovered. I had all the genetic testing done, and similarly to Christina, I didn't have those markers. So it was a little bit like I asked myself the question, well, what caused this then? And there's just that unknown, I think, that a lot of us young women have to deal with.
I mean, I wish you could go back in time and talk to your 37-year-old self with your powerhouse self now and say, you know, hey, you know, I'm on the other side of this, but that first diagnosis, you know, been around and had discussions with loved ones. And it's like, it feels like it's a mountain of time. And am I going to get to the other side of this? And what is required, et cetera? What goes through your mind when you got that diagnosis?
I mean, it's overwhelming. You know, you have a whole bunch of mixed emotions like, okay, we're going to be fine and I can do this. And then overwhelming fear and, you know, just kind of reeling from, well, what's next? Because all of a sudden your whole reality opens up to you have to find doctors and you're given so much information that you don't even understand, you know. And so just relying on a good care team to help you navigate these waters, it's a lot.
And your particular care involved not just surgery, which, you know, I think a lot of reasonable people would hope that could be the end of it, but, you know, if the cancer's in the lymph nodes, and it's going to probably require chemo, and it did for you, right?
It did, and radiation.
And, you know, that's tough, but you feel good? You feel good today?
I do. But it's been nearly 3 years.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time.
You're coming up on that 3-year anniversary. And do you now notice a little bit more of it around you? I mean, just in sort of extended circles, it seems to me that when you get a diagnosis in your 30s, it's almost like you start seeing it in a lot of places you didn't realize, and it's more common. Do you feel that way?
I mean, yeah. When you go through something like this, you're profoundly marked by it, and so you notice it everywhere. And, you know, I love this conversation because I feel like, for me, having daughters as well, I want to look at my surroundings and say, okay, what can we do to help you avoid what I've had to go through myself?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also had a conversation recently. There's been so much cancer, and there was a pretty young cancer diagnosis. And I feel like two very different ways about chemo. And maybe I'll get Dr. O'Connell. Maybe I'll get everybody on this in a second here. But Becky, the way I feel about chemo is, number one, I feel blessed to be living in an age where if I need it, it's there, and it can do remarkable things to potentially extend my life or the life of someone I'm related to or I love. At the same time, it's pretty amazing when you hear a discussion about chemo like, well, you know, this person is young and maybe we wouldn't recommend it for someone who's in a late stage of life, but we want to make sure if there's anything left behind, that there's nothing left, that the chemo wipes it out. And it feels like, you know, you're looking for a needle in a haystack and you go, well, let's just burn the whole barn down and then hopefully that gets the needle. And you know, eventually you rebuild the barn and the barn's going to be okay. So chemo is this amazing thing where previous generations didn't have it. and literally died because they didn't have it. It's also, it feels still clumsy. Like, we eventually will have something a little more targeted, a little better than this, but I feel blessed to be in an age of it. How do you feel?
Well, that's a question. Yeah, I mean, chemo...
Nobody loves chemo when they go through it.
Yeah, chemo was, it was rough. It made me and everyone else who takes it extremely sick. But I felt good saying, you know, because it was found in my lymph nodes, I do want to fight for my life.
Yeah.
And chemo was a great option for me to say, well, let's take this precaution and let's go through the next few months of this illness. And I mean, it's literally poisoning your body, but it's killing what you don't want to be there potentially. And then, you know, radiation to follow up is more targeted, and that helps as well. And so for me, going through everything that I could helped give me the peace of mind that we have gotten the clear, you know, and it wasn't until, you know, January of 2023 that my doctors looked at me and said, you're cancer free. And those three words were life altering for me to know that, like, we've done it. Now, it could show up. We never know. But I feel good that we have had the opportunity to have the treatments here that I've gotten in Rochester with the amazing care team that I've had that have brought me to the place where I feel pretty good about, I don't walk around in fear. Mm-hmm. We've done what we can.
Yeah. How often do you think about wanting to rescreen or rescan? And do you, are you comfortable with the plan for you with that?
I mean, yeah, it's mammograms every year, right? And I automatically get the ultrasounds as well. And so, yeah, I'm a big advocate for going. You know, I had pain, and that is what triggered it for me. But I think even if we have really dense tissue, which most of us young women have, I think it's still crucial, like, to say it's still worth it if we do find it. Like, go get that, you know?
How do you feel about chemo, Dr. O'Connell?
Well, two things, and then let me come back to the pain.
Because
generally, pain is so common, so, so very common. And the vast majority of pain is hormonal or nothing. But
it's not cancer, is what you're saying.
And yeah, the vast majority of pain. But I'm happy to have people with pain come and get checked out because it's people like you. As for chemo, imagine, and I had this discussion with a friend quite, you know, a different cancer, but the fifth round was coming and she was absolutely miserable from the four. Mm. And the question was, does that fifth one, does anybody know? And the how many doses you need and how many different drugs you need, because you want everything. So the thing is right now, and it'll take years for people to do a trial where this person gets four drugs and goes for 9 months, and this person gets three drugs and goes for six. And then you have to follow them for the rest of their lives to see if they could have taken less treatment. It's very difficult. And of course, you have a young person in front of you, and you want to never say, I didn't do everything.
Right.
And you don't walk around every twinge you get in the future thinking, oh, I should have taken that chemo. You've done everything, so you have that peace of mind. You've eradicated every cancer cell in your body. So that's a good feeling for you. And of course, anybody can get another cancer in the future, and it won't be you.
Becky's done her time, okay?
You've done it. You've done. I mean, I know tons of people who had all of this 30 years ago, and they're walking around just with some scar tissue and saying, I'm glad I did everything. So I think you'll be always glad you went through that misery, and we know it's misery. Someday, with radiation, they're doing less. It's whole breast, and then it's targeted breast. And hopefully with chemo, there's trials out there. Anybody who gets offered a clinical trial should always get into it, because it's what makes it better for the next round. Does that last drug change anything? Can we reduce the amount of toxicity? So I think that brings in a little blurb on clinical trials, because that's where we're going to find out how whether we can remove any of the toxicity.
Well, how do you feel, Christina, about chemo and where we might be going in the future?
All right. Well, if you had asked me this question about 6 years ago, maybe not a big fan, but I will say a few things. My breast cancer diagnosis was non-hormonal and positive for HER2. So I went through treatment during a time when there were two targeted therapies for it that also get delivered with chemotherapy. I'm very, very thankful that this is the case, because it wasn't a great prognosis before those were developed. My cancer started by me feeling a lump in my armpit, which was a lymph node full of cancer. And after the first treatment, probably 6 or 7 days, I couldn't feel it any longer. So it was effective. yeah, I didn't feel great some of the time. Other times I did feel okay. And it's just a message to myself back then to just slow down. We'll get through each day. And this is for the long run. So I really look forward to seeing all of the work that we're going to do on targeted therapies, really hone in on less toxicity, have that survivorship part of it, not have to include such things to our cardiac system, to our lungs, and that sort of thing. And that's the direction we're really going.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me work through some listener feedback here. Questions from the audience. And again, it's connections at WXXI.org if you want to reach out to the program today. Listener who would prefer not to share their name is wondering about MRI for women with dense breasts. With that starting earlier, is there any concern about the contrast agent? Is there any way that a non-contrast MRI would be sufficient for screening, or is ultrasound the best for early screening of dense breasts? Dr. O'Connell?
There's at least three questions in there. Number one, let me start with the contrast. That's the easier one. We had concerns about contrast a while ago and Parkinson's and deposition in the brain. Since then, newer agents have been introduced, and there's not been a clinical trial of a million people one way and a million people the other way, but it's considered that if you need an MRI, the contrast is, and people will need it, the contrast is safe. The second thing was, you've dense breasts, you can't go straight to MRI because it's very expensive. And if you want your insurance to cover it, you have to trigger the 20% lifetime risk, which is a calculation that includes your breast density, but needs something else, usually family history. And what was the third question?
Is ultrasound the best for early screening of dense breasts?
Together with mammography. There are some things the ultrasound shows and you go back to the mammogram, you cannot see it. And there are some things the mammogram shows and you go and you look and look with ultrasound and you can't see it. The two together are better.
Another question with a listener asking to remain anonymous says, how can I best support a friend who is facing a recurrence? Let me start with the team from the Breast Cancer Coalition does amazing work with this. Christina Thompson's the executive director. And to this listener, we send all the love to you and the people around you. Where do you start with this, Christina?
It's a great question. I think especially like you mentioned in earlier, the month of October, the pink ribbons, we know a lot of people that are living with metastatic breast cancer, with advanced gynecologic cancer. They have a stark reality that treatment is going to happen for the rest of their lives. I just want to say you're not alone. First and foremost, there are people that we can connect you with that can share their stories that really exemplify the fact that you will get through this day. I think as far as how a friend can support someone, just encourage them to reach out to the coalition if they haven't. There's never a wrong time. We have a group called Common Ground that meets weekly, and these are people that are living life intentionally because they have the reality that cancer could cut it shorter than it should.
And I think maybe we should make sure that people understand that if there's someone in your life with this kind of a diagnosis, the coalition can be really helpful, and you don't have to have cancer yourself to reach out to the coalition, right?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. Use those resources.
Yes.
I've seen you're nodding over there. You want to add to that, Becky?
No, I had a great support system when I was diagnosed. I have great family, awesome friends, but I had people recommend to go talk to the coalition, and I don't really need that. It's okay. I have good support. But I did, and I couldn't even tell you, I didn't realize how much of a reassurance it was to be in the same room as other women who have been through what I've been through, and I felt known. And that was crucial. And the support that I was given at the coalition, like, it made a big difference for me. And so I would just encourage you, the gift of presence can be super helpful, even if you don't understand what your friend is going through, just to be there. But then also the coalition is a fantastic place that can be a great set of resources for them.
Doctor?
Yeah, the word recurrence should not automatically spell everybody doom and gloom. I mean, there's treatment. It means you've got to go through more treatment. But when you already had lymph nodes involved, you were into this, like, there might be more treatment down. I think people should really be positive. The coalition for support, but I mean, the oncologists have still lots of ammunition to fight it. It's not, I think doom and gloom is probably not helpful for the friend.
Another email from Ellen who says, a few weeks ago I saw a story on Full Measure and the doctor interviewed was saying there's research that says a virus may be responsible for breast cancer. It needs more research. Maybe a vaccine can be made. This is from Ellen. Dr. O'Connell, a virus.
I hadn't heard that one.
Okay. So no information I've seen on a virus. However, there's a lot of headlines about a possible breast cancer vaccine. And I'm wondering what you think about that, Dr. O'Connell. Are we going to see a breast cancer vaccine?
Well, if maybe in my lifetime, I'm not sure. I mean, a virus, there are cancers that are associated with viruses. I've not heard that, but I have heard some kind of rumbles and grumbles about vaccines. But at this point, there's nothing usable, really. But I think research, listen, when research asks for your money to do research on breast cancer, that's where it might go to somebody to develop the next thing. Because if we could just, you know, take the people with the high risk and give them some sort of preventive thing. But I don't know enough about it to make any.
Ellen, I'm going to do my best just to summarize a little bit of the research from a couple of medical institutes that are working on this. They're not working on a breast cancer vaccine because the idea is that breast cancer comes from a virus. That's not what's going on. The vaccine would be related to responding to tumor proteins and blocking the growth of tumors. Could this kind of vaccine, I mean, maybe vaccine triggers an idea of a virus in people's minds, but maybe this vaccine would be helpful at least slowing or blocking tumor growth, Dr. O'Connell.
It may be in the category of the newer treatments, the T-cell treatments for some of, like a melanoma. It may not be a jab like you get for your COVID, but it may be some kind of immune treatment to block the cells, like killer T-cells we used to talk about years ago. So I think immune treatment is a huge new future. So it wouldn't be the same as a flu vaccine, but I think maybe some kind of immunotherapy.
Christina, is that anything that you're keeping on your radar?
So a couple of interesting things that have come up to me, and I love Dr. O'Connell's thought about donating money to breast cancer research. However, I think that there's a lot, especially this month, that we see that may not really have the best of intentions. So asking the questions on exactly where is this going is just the first and foremost. And I don't think this is just breast cancer and October. I think this is all donations of money, period. I do think that there is research going into vaccines for breast cancer. I know the National Breast Cancer Coalition has an Artemis project, which funds really cutting edge research like this, and that's something they're working on. But again, like Dr. O'Connell said, I do not know.
Okay. Let me also just kind of work in Dan emailed to ask a question about if we've learned any more about causes of triple negative. So this is probably a good time to step back. And as we talk about breast cancer, not all breast cancer is the same. There's HER2, mm-hmm. Christina?
Yes.
That was yours?
Yes.
Okay. Becky, can you share what yours was?
Yeah, mine was hormone positive.
Hormone positive.
Yep.
Estrogen and progesterone fueled. Okay. You know, working against your body. I mean, it's amazing how cancer works. But then those are two, and then there's triple negative. Dan wants to know if we've learned more about triple negative. Dr. O'Connell, what do we mean when we say triple negative?
Yeah, that's the category of breast cancer that's negative for hormone receptors, estrogen, progesterone, and HER2. That's the third one, triple. You were probably double negative, double positive, one negative.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. There is more knowledge out there because those are the kind of cancers that are quite common in younger women, younger African-American women. There is one of the genetic mutations that is more likely to be triple negative. So I think that the different kind of triple negative used to be the worst diagnosis of breast cancers, but thanks to modern treatment, which is again research, you know, clinical trials. But so triple negative is a specific kind, and yes, there is more understanding of why it's different from the others because it's quite different, but it's quite treatable. So that's good.
Yeah.
But not with the original, not the same treatment that Becky would
have had. Different treatment,
okay. Yeah.
How does the treatment differ?
Well, different chemotherapy.
Different chemo.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be it wouldn't be against the estrogen and progesterone. It has to be against a cancer, like a different cancer in the body. So it's more the commoner type of chemotherapies that were used for other cancers. But it is better. It used to be the worst thing. It is still a terrible thing because it's young African. And that's why it's so important for people in their 30s, if they feel a lump, don't assume it's a cyst, don't assume it's a fibroadenoma, because that's what your friend had. Get it checked, because that's the best way, because those cancers grow fast and they tend to be in younger women who don't expect, they really, when young women get a lump, the last thing they expect is cancer, so they don't go. So the thing is, get checked out quickly, because the sooner you make a diagnosis, the sooner you get the treatment, the sooner you get back to being your normal self.
We're going to continue to work through the feedback that you have here as we talk about breast cancer guidelines, recommendations, awareness, and support. You're hearing Dr. Avis O'Connell, a radiologist with Rochester Regional Health. Christina Thompson's the executive director of the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester. Becky Arcady is a survivor and telling her story here as well. Christina, by the way, where can people get online to find more about the coalition?
Great question. Just go to bccr.org.
And I know in terms of the work that's going on and the funds that are necessary, you got a fundraiser you want to talk about. Tell people about
it. We do. October is taking place on the 10th of October at the MAG. Tickets are still available through that website as well as our silent auction. And everything that is raised goes right back to the coalition, to the 27 counties that we serve, and allows us to have programs and services that are at no charge to the person impacted by their diagnosis.
It's next Wednesday.
Yeah, Thursday.
Next Thursday. What day is today?
The second? I'm not sure.
It's the second.
No, today's the first.
Today is the first.
Yeah, this October
starts. Next Thursday. Don't ever trust a journalist. Come on. It's next Thursday at the MAG.
Yes.
And again, where tickets where?
bccr.org, or you can call the office, 473-8177.
I'm just going to keep working through your feedback here. We got a lot of it. And on the subject of recurrence, Tom writes to say, my wife is a two-time breast cancer survivor, 1991 and then again 2008. She is strong, positive, great attitude, great outlook, and support all our critical survival tactics. So there you go, Dr. O'Connell. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know every person's story is different, and recurrence is a horrible word, and it's not anything anybody wants to hear. But Tom's point about his wife is that mm-hmm. You know, she has been there, done that, and she's doing great today, and that should be inspiring, I hope.
Absolutely. Yeah. I always... I do this crabby old woman thing. I say, you know, my job is to get you, because I'm the diagnosis person, not the treatment person. But I said, we move you on to the team. And the idea is to make you a crabby old woman. And I said, we want to, you choose the crabbiness and we'll try and get you to old. We want everybody to become a crabby old woman if they want to be crabby and not have this be the reason that, I mean, there's no reason with today's medicine that people can't become crabby old women with it. I mean, the thing people often say to somebody with a diagnosis, you're going to die with this, not of this. Mm-hmm. And so that applies to any survivor. Well, not really when you've been completely treated. But some people, they get a low grade. I'm not talking about breast cancer necessarily here, but, you know, to have it, it's in your history now, but you're going to die hopefully of old age in your sleep.
I'm going to repeat what I heard a great doctor once say to a loved one who said, yes, you have a cancer diagnosis. Yes, you're young. No, this is not going to kill you. Yes, you will die someday. You will die a little old lady deep in your bed. And I love that. So
that's
there
it.
You go.
Not crabby, though.
Well, maybe crabby. Crabby's okay. Linda says, I have the opposite of dense breasts and zero, no family history on either side of breast cancer. I also eat very healthy. I'm largely vegan. At my last mammogram, the professional wrote for the results, 100% fatty tissue. What about the radiation from mammograms? The radiation, to at least some extent, increases the risk of cancer. And for me, it is overkill to get a mammogram every year. For me, the risk of the radiation is a concern of mine. Please discuss this. I would like to hear a person address this who can understand my perspective. That's from Linda.
Very good. First of all, that is the lowest density, which means that the cancer, if there was one, would show very easily. So mammogram should be enough. The dose rate, the dose for a mammogram has been reduced over the years and now is not much different from life background radiation from just walking around buildings and the soil and solar and everything. So the amount of radiation in a mammogram is so low that it has never, ever been associated. It's not the kind of rate, if you extrapolate from people who got cancer after, say, the Japanese bomb exposure, people did get cancer then, and you extrapolate that their dose down to the dose from a mammogram, it doesn't even trigger. So, but it's an individual discussion. And if somebody with fatty breasts asked me, is it okay if I come every 2 years? I'd say, you're the one. And some people do choose to come every 2 years. And then they, you know, and I can't give a person advice that I don't know. But I mean, there are people who'll come every two. They'll say, look, I've always been negative. Family history is clear. I'll come every two. And that's their choice.
I want to return to the issue of metastatic cancer. I want to ask Christina a little bit about how, you know, some people have written to Congress about how to support people with metastatic disease. And I want to give you a little space if you want to talk about that part of the story as well here.
I would love to, Evan. This is so near and dear to my heart. So in Congress currently, we are in our third session, which means sixth year of supporting H.R. 549. It is the Metastatic Breast Cancer Access to Care Act. And if this passes, and we are extremely close, we are at about 260 congressional co-sponsors. We need 290 to get to a vote. But the clock is ticking. So basically, anyone who is diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer under the age of 65, the way I like to explain it is they're going to work, they're going to continue their normal life as long as they can until the treatments or the symptoms become too much for them to continue a full-time career. In this scenario, there is a forced, mandated 5-month wait for this person to collect Social Security disability income, which is a portion of their income when working, and an additional 24 months for them to access Medicare as their health care. They've been paying into this the whole time. They will not get a refund check. And a lot of time at this point, they may not have 2.5 years left to live. So I see people that are struggling because they carry the family's medical insurance, and so they decide to continue working because they can't take that risk. There are other people who want to quit working or step down a little bit, and they know that that Social Security disability is not going to be enough to cover the COBRA premiums. So they are deciding, I'm going to live the last however many months I have continuing to work rather than prioritizing with family and my health. This is unacceptable. There are already waivers for these wait times if you're in the same situation and you have ALS or you have end-stage renal disease. So all we need Congress to do is add metastatic breast cancer to the list. I am proud to say with all of the efforts of survivors and advocates that work on this, we have the majority of our New York State congressional members signed on, with the exception of Claudia Tenney, who's in the 24th District. She's on the Ways and Means Committee, so it is extremely important for us to garner her support. And in years past, she has signed on. We have metastatic people living with metastatic disease knocking down her doors that are constituents, and we really just cannot get any feedback. So if there's more information or if you want ways that you can help with this effort, please contact us at the coalition.
Okay, before we lose the hour, I'll just squeeze in a little bit more. A very different question. We had the question about fatty tissue and maybe not doing every year. Anna is asking, and just trying to edit an email down here. Anna's essentially saying, what's the problem with doing it every year and even starting younger? Why not start at 30? Why not start even younger than that? Is there a harm to doing more in terms of mammograms?
Well, two things there. The other reason I didn't mention of age 40 is that breasts are more radiation sensitive, even to low doses of radiation, the younger the breast tissue is. And that's why up to age 25, the breasts might be continuing to develop and they're more sensitive. So we don't know. And plus, it was a two-sided thing. First of all, the mammogram is not much good in a 25-year-old because it's super dense. So you'd see calcifications, you'd see maybe lymph nodes, but you would not pick up subtle cancers. So that's why under 30 is too young. And the breasts are still developing to a degree, or at least they're hormone sensitive. And that's why under age 35 was one of our, used to be our deadline. But of course, you know, it's not going to cause cancer. Well, we don't know. We don't want to radiate the breast of a younger person. We wouldn't ever do a mammogram in a teenager. So at what point do we transition? So that's why 25 was a kind of our hard stop. So, yeah, I mean, a person in their 30s could certainly, they really shouldn't, unless they had a strong risk. They shouldn't get a mammogram before 40 unless they had risk factors.
Would you be concerned about false positives? How common are false positives?
Oh, they're very common. Ooh, so false positive is not what we have to define. False positive means we saw something and it ended up not being cancer. We never said it was cancer. We never biopsied it. We never treated it. Well, we may have biopsied. We may have treated it, but we never called it cancer, but it's still categorized as a false positive. So 100 people get a mammogram, 10 are going to be called back. And then if those are negative, they're false positives. So of those,
even though you never said to those 10,
you said
cancer.
We're not sure what's going on.
So a callback, which is going to give somebody anxiety.
Yep.
Doesn't necessarily mean you got cancer.
No, but it's called a false positive. So of the callbacks, 6 of those 10 will be told you're fine. It was just overlapping tissue. I'm sure people are familiar. You're all set. See you next year. That was a false positive. And then the other 2 are told, well, 2 of the other 4 are told, we'll check you in 6 months. It's probably nothing. So you go 6 months. And then 2 get a biopsy. And of them, 80% are negative, so a tiny percentage. They're all false positives, and everybody who didn't have cancer, including the biopsy, are considered false positives. We never told them they had cancer. We said we want to be careful. So that's the trouble with getting mammograms in younger, dense breasts.
Okay. Well, I hope as we wrap here, one of the things that is left with listeners is the medical system in the ideal world would start screening at the perfect exact time that it's effective. Never a day before and never a day later. It would catch everything in advance and create the earliest possible treatment. The reason they're moving from 50 to 40 for everybody is because they think that's going to save lives, that will get ahead of it for more people. Yes, doctor, right?
Yes, that is exactly right.
So if you're 40 or above and you've been hearing 50, 50, 50, I don't have breast cancer in the family, it's 40 now. So there you go. Dr. Avis O'Connell, a pleasure as always.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Becky Arcady, good luck to you. Continued good health. Thank you for telling your story.
You're welcome. Thanks.
And Christina Thompson at the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester. Your coalition does amazing work. I know it from experience. It's wonderful. Thank you for what you do.
Thanks for having us on.
More connections coming up in a moment.